Morning, everyone. We have four cases on the docket this morning, and we'll start with Eaves versus Polis, 23-11-43. And speaking for myself, we received the notice of transfer at 7:47 a.m. this morning. So please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Governor Polis respects every individual's right to religious free exercise. He also respects the right of federal courts in this circuit to sit in judgment on federal question claims alleging violations of that right, like those that survived the motions to dismiss here. But with respect to the limited subset of claims at issue on this, in this appeal, Colorado law imposes no particular duty on Governor Polis to supervise the activities of private contract prisons like BCCF or to create policies and procedures that govern CDOC's operations and facilities.
So if this were not a private facility, would he agree that he would be a proper party?
No, Your Honor. I do believe that Colorado statutes governing the Department of Corrections also impose the same duty to supervise the activities and adopt policies and procedures on the executive director with respect to all correctional facilities, not just private contract prisons like BCCF.
Okay. And you would agree, though, that if this were state court, that he'd be subject to suit directly?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The 11th Amendment is with very limited exceptions, not applicable here, like the Alden v. Maine case is not applicable to state law claims in state courts.
Okay.
Wasn't this before the district court with a 12B6 motion?
Your Honor, it was both a 12B6 motion by the governor, but also a Rule 12B1 motion, because under this court's precedent, sovereign immunity should be asserted as a jurisdictional defense under Rule 12B1.
Well, under 12B6, though, don't we have to take the allegations as we see them in the complaint?
Your Honor, both under...
That's a simple question, counsel.
And I'm prepared to answer it, yes, Your Honor. The court is required to take all well-pled, in other words, plausible allegations in the complaint as true. And the governor's argument is that Mr. Eaves' allegations in the operative amended complaint are highly conclusory in nature and also highly implausible because they directly contradict the plain language of Colorado law, which in fact imposes the precise duties he's complaining about on another set of state officials.
Well,
go ahead.
When you say they're conclusory and they contradict Colorado law, what about the complaint on pages 17 and 22 that specifically alleged that Governor Polis participated in developing the very policy that underlies Mr. Eaves' claim for religious inability to exercise his religious rights?
I'm sorry to interrupt, Your Honor. Yes, I am aware of the allegations that the court is pointing to. The defendant was able to group Governor Polis in with other prison officials, but the reason Governor Polis maintains those allegations are implausible and not well pled is because they directly contradict state law, which says that in fact CDOC's executive director sets policy.
And so you're saying that it is so clear that it is impossible to believe that a governor can participate with a subordinate for whom he has an absolute right to discharge at will, that it is implausible that the governor would have helped the executive director of the DOC to develop this policy.
I am saying it is implausible under Colorado law and this court's precedent, which talks about the particular duty existing under Colorado law in the Peterson v. Martinez case.
All right. But follow up to Judge Baldock's question, for your 12B1 motion, this is a facial attack, right? You didn't submit any affidavits in district court in support of the 12B1 motion, right?
There were no affidavits attached in support of the motion.
So we credit the allegations in the complaint favorably to the plaintiff. We credit those just as we would a 12B6 motion, right?
If they are well-pled and plausible, which the governor's position is they are not. And in fact, he did, I just want to make the point that he did join in CDOC's Rule 12B1 and 12B6 motion to dismiss, which attached as exhibits the policies adopted by CDOC's executive director. Those are AR-800-01. They are in the record in the appendix volume 2 before this court. Inserted into the record under the CDOC defendant's Rule 12B1 motion. So the governor did ask the court to take judicial notice of those.
One last question, and then I'll be quiet. If we conclude that Mr. Eaves did plead the allegation on 17 and 22 that Governor Polis participated in developing the policy, whether or not he was obligated to or not, that it wasn't contrary to the policy, he was just helping his subordinate. Is there any basis to distinguish that situation from Governor Stitt's issuance of the executive order in Fowler versus Stitt?
Yes, Your Honor. There are two primary distinctions. First, in Fowler v. Stitt, the governor's executive order was at issue. In this case, there had been an executive order issued by Governor Polis during the COVID-19 pandemic, but the trial court dismissed all of Mr. Eaves' claims related to that period of restriction. And as a result, the governor's prior executive orders, which are no longer in effect, as moot. And so those claims are no longer at issue in this appeal. But additionally, if this court were to find that, again, what plaintiff is pointing to are the governor's general executive authority under state law, including his power to hire and fire the heads of his cabinet departments, of which CDOC is one of, I believe, at least 20, if not more. We've added a couple of late. But the test for whether the ex parte Young exception applies, it requires both a particular duty under state law and a demonstrated willingness to enforce that duty. And here, I do not understand Mr. Eaves' remaining claims, and again, those of the limited subset at issue in this appeal, to concern the face of AR-800-01. Rather, they concern the application of that policy to Mr. Eaves by BCCF prison officials, something in which the complaint does not allege that Governor Polis took a direct participation and role in. So still under this court's precedent, we would argue that the test for ex parte Young is not satisfied.
So let me back you up. We were talking about, in fact, you brought it up, Alden v. Maine. And we, before that, I'd asked you if you agreed that he would be subject to suit in state court, and you agreed that the answer is yes. If this had been brought in state court, the governor would have been subject to suit.
Yes, in state court under state law causes of action, not federal causes of action necessarily.
No, I understand that. So, but do you agree that Alden stands for the proposition that the 11th Amendment immunity does not provide additional immunity than the governor would have in state court?
I understand Alden v. Maine to be specific to federal question claims for money damages brought by a defendant under Section 1983 in state court. And I understand part of Alden v. Maine to hold that the 11th Amendment is a bar to such claims. But I think the larger point in the trial court's reference to Colorado Supreme Court decisions is that all of those cases, and I have had the privilege of litigating many of them, concern state law causes of action brought in state law forums or state court forums to which 11th Amendment sovereign immunity just was not an issue. It was not a legal issue in Raven v. Polis, in Ainscough v. Owens, in Developmental Pathways versus Ritter. It just is in a posit, and that's because under Colorado law, the governor can always be sued as the embodiment of the state for litigation purposes. That is directly the opposite of the 11th Amendment. And Mr. Eaves' assertion that it matters not whether the governor would be subjected to enormous burden to be named in literally every lawsuit brought by an inmate who felt that their rights were violated by prison officials is inconsequential, I somewhat agreed, because the truth is the 11th Amendment is an entitlement. It's an absolute bar to the trial court's jurisdiction, and not in the nature of sovereign immunity, or I'm sorry, of qualified immunity, but rather it is an immunity from suit, a jurisdictional bar to the exercise of jurisdiction over certain types of claims. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, we'll stop the clock, Paul. And, I don't want to deprive my colleagues of questions, so you can go ahead.
I would like, before she sits down, if you don't mind, would you go ahead and you filed a notice this morning at about 7:45 saying that there was potential, that we had potential, that we had a prudential mootness issue in this case. Would you go ahead and just give us the 2-cent version of that?
Thank you, Your Honor. I will. And I did file it yesterday evening at about, I thought, 5:45, but it probably showed up this morning, for which, you know, I am sorry. I'll just say, I entered in this case, in this appeal, 2 months ago, and I've been studying hard for this oral argument, and in reading plaintiff's brief, or Mr. Eve's brief before this court, I was struck by his wording and his references to being in the custody of a correctional facility as opposed to BCCF, which is the prison facility where he was incarcerated at the time of the allegations and the operative amended complaint. And it just troubled me. It didn't sit right. And so yesterday I looked into it, and through the inmate locator available on the Department of Corrections website, I was able to ascertain that Mr. Eves was, in fact, is currently in the custody of Sterling Correctional Facility. And I then did further outreach to CDOC's legal counsel, who were able to share with me that he was, in fact, transferred to Sterling, or I'm sorry, I should say he was no longer in the custody of BCCF as of August 23rd, 2023, well over a year ago, and well before he filed his brief in this court. And I think that this goes directly to the issue of mootness of his claims under the Jordan v. Sosa case, and that it should have been raised much, much sooner by Mr. Eves in particular.
Where is Sterling Correctional Facility?
It's in Colorado, Your Honor.
So what difference does it make?
Oh, it absolutely makes every difference. The claims at issue in this appeal are for injunctive relief for violations of his religious free exercise rights committed while in custody at BCCF. If he's no longer in BCCF's custody,
Are you saying that the governor doesn't have any authority over DOC and the DOC has no authority over a Colorado inmate while they're at Sterling?
Mr. Eves is absolutely within the custody and control of CDOC at Sterling Correctional Facilities, but there's no allegations before this court or the court below related to any violations of his free exercise rights at Sterling Correctional Facility. And the Jordan v. Sosa case, on the same facts presented here, show that the transfer of an inmate who is alleging constitutional claims by prison officials at one facility, who that same inmate is later transferred to a different facility, those claims are mooted constitutionally, prudentially, and no exception to mootness applies.
And you bear the burden on mootness, right?
I believe mootness goes to jurisdiction, which usually the plaintiff bears the burden on, but I recall that you might be right. So I think I am right.
So the question then is just a practical one. You're telling us, let's say the night before oral argument, mm-hmm. that months ago, August, he was transferred to Sterling, and that we should assume that his religious rights as a member of the Second Fox tribe might be being honored at Sterling. You're not telling us that they are. You're not telling us anything one way or the other. And so we are supposed to say, well, we don't know if he is being if he is really getting the rights that he was complaining about. You're not even presenting evidence. You're not telling us that he is, But you're just saying, well, he might be, and so this is something you might worry about, panel. I'm not telling you that he is. I have the burden on mootness, and so I'm kind of at a loss about what you want us to do with this.
Yeah, you've got a whole different case before us now. It really irritates me to have prepared for this case, and last night or this morning early get a notice that we may be arguing about a completely different case. That's not right to the court, nor is it right to other colleagues or people who are arguing today. And you say you just took this case over 2 months ago. Was that my understanding?
Your Honor, I entered my appearance on September 16th. I think approximately the fifth counsel from this office to have entered on this case. But I do believe that Mr. Eaves and his counsel were aware of this change in his custody and failed at every opportunity to inform this court. And I, as an officer of the court, could not stand before you here today and ask you to make an important ruling on the governor's sovereign immunity, knowing full well under this court's binding precedent, again, Jordan v. Sosa, that Mr. Eaves' claims likely are moot. And I share this court's irritation, to be perfectly clear, with Mr. Eaves for failing to bring the fact of his custody to this court's attention. And I believe that the governor's lack of awareness further illustrates the fact that he is not involved in the day-to-day operations of any prison in Colorado, including BCCF, and had no reason to have any knowledge as to why or when Mr. Eaves was transferred well over a year ago. I was personally concluding my preparation for today's oral argument when this fact came to light, and I spent several hours both running down the factual information needed to prepare and file the notice, but then also studying up on mootness, which I agree with Your Honor. I'm not prepared to address at length today, nor do I anticipate that my counsel is or that the court is either. And so I think the appropriate manner to address this issue is to order supplemental briefing from the parties, which has been done many times when this court has ascertained a mootness concern.
Yeah, I'm not speaking for the panel. I haven't heard anything yet that you've told me any reason to have a mootness concern, but we'll keep that in mind.
Yeah, Your Honor.
I have not cheated you out of your rebuttal. You still
okay.
Have to fight.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Anything else, Jordan? No. Thank you.
Judge Wallen?
No.
All right. We'll hear from the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Jeffrey Thin for Plaintiff Appellee Rodney Douglas Eaves. Your Honors, I was originally planning to start today by focusing on the principal question before this Court and explain why the District Court's decision was correct that Governor Polis has some connection to the enforcement of acts that have violated my client's religious rights. And I'm happy to answer any questions that the Court has on that front. But I did want to first address the governor's letter from last night, which it sounds like the Corps received this morning, which raised the possibility that Mr. Eaves' transfer in August of 2023, which I will note was 6 months before Governor Polis even filed their opening brief in this case, may have mooted his claims for injunctive relief. And as this Court has held and acknowledged earlier today, Governor Polis bears the heavy burden of demonstrating that there is mootness. And I don't believe that Governor Polis can meet that burden. And I'd like to tell the Court why, and I'm prepared to do so, as illustrated by the case that Governor Polis was just referring to and cited in their letter, Jordan v. Sosa. And if the Court will permit me, I would like to read just a portion of Jordan v. Sosa. There the Court said, where a prisoner brings a lawsuit challenging policies that apply in a generally uniform fashion throughout a prison system, courts have been disinclined to conclude that the prisoner's declaratory or injunctive claims are moot even after transfer. Now, Mr. Eaves here is challenging policies that are system-wide and applied uniformly throughout the prison system and are not specific to the Brent County Correctional Facility. And I'll just name a few, for example. Mr. Eaves alleged that he was not allowed and is still not allowed to possess sacred objects such as his personal pipe, his flute, drum, all sacred objects that are fundamental to his ability to practice the Sacred Fox religion. He was not allowed, and he is still not allowed to spiritually cleanse his cell or embellish his medicine bag or headband, which again are central tenets of his Sacred Fox religion. And he still doesn't have access to firewood due to a loophole in the policy which allows him to donate money for the purchase of firewood, but that firewood is then not earmarked specifically for the use of the tribal community.
Is there a process, counsel? I'm hearing what you're saying, and it's almost falling on a deaf brain. But are there procedures at the new place, the new facility, going through that he should have applied? Because they very well could. We don't know whether they have or have not. You say they have not granted him. But is there a procedure at the new place, like there are at any place, that you go through a certain procedure and ask for these things? Has he done that at the new place where he's being housed? Or do you even know?
I'm not familiar yet with whether he has supported that. My understanding from conversations with my client and with trial counsel is that he is still not able to do the things that he has complained of in this complaint, and that he complains the governor and others are responsible for denying him at this point. And to the extent that there is a claim that the prisons are now allowing him to do those things, then Governor Polis, through his counsel, had the opportunity today when they came before this court to say he is now allowed to possess sacred objects. He is now allowed to cleanse his cell. But they did not do that, and they can't. And they have not done that. And they bear the burden to demonstrate that under this court's precedent. And it is a heavy burden. And I don't believe that they have done that. And I don't think that this court, as the court acknowledged, can assume that those violations of Mr. Eve's rights have somehow been corrected. And I just want to make one other point.
I know you want to make, but what is the case that we have before us today? What is the case that we have here?
Your Honor, the case that we have before us today is the same case that was briefed before this court. The governor's letter about mootness, I don't think, impacts this case at all. And I want to demonstrate that by just pointing to Jordan v. Sosa one more time, since the governor did rely on it. In Jordan v. Sosa, the issue was Mr. Jordan, the plaintiff there, only sued officials at the facility where he was housed. So when he was transferred, there was no defendant left that this court could enjoin or compel to grant him prospective relief, because he had only sued those individuals that were at the prison where he was being transferred from. So in that manner, Jordan is not applicable at all to this case and is completely distinguishable.
Well, what is applicable to this case, counsel? And I hope to not come across too disturbed, but I am in regards to this, is that the only issue then that we have absolutely to consider in this is whether or not the governor is entitled to 11th Amendment immunity. No other, based on the facts of what we have before us. It's only that issue that doesn't reach where he's located now, which could be all relitigated at another time, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. Our position is that
you won't hear from me again.
Okay,
go ahead and proceed with your argument.
No worries, Your Honor. And thank you. But yes, our position is that the principal question for this court under the Ex parte Young analysis, which this court has held, is a straightforward inquiry, which asks whether the complaint alleges ongoing violation of federal law, and seeks, a relief that is characterized as prospective. And I think one thing that is helpful of the conversation we just had, Your Honor, is that Mr. Eves clearly meets that standard. We've just spoken about the prospective relief that he is seeking, which is the same relief that he was seeking from when he filed his complaint and he was housed at Brent County Correctional Facility.
Well, it's not in dispute that you're seeking prospective relief. I mean, everybody agrees with that, I believe. The question's whether there's an exception to the Ex parte Young doctrine that would prevent you from bringing the governor in.
And I don't think there is, Your Honor. The question that this court often asks is whether there is some connection between the defendant and the enforcement of acts that the plaintiff alleges have violated their constitutional rights. And I think that Mr. Eaves has shown that in his complaint in three ways. First, there are the allegations that Mr. Eaves has made directly connecting the governor to the deprivation of his rights. And I'll come back to that in one second. There's also the fact that Mr. Eaves has pointed to Colorado law. And I think Colorado law is important because it, for the purposes of this analysis, we have to understand what is the particular duty of this state official. And Colorado law tells us that the particular duty of the governor is that he oversees the CDOC, he appoints the executive director of the CDOC, and that director serves at the pleasure of the governor. And lastly, under this court's precedent in Kitchen, it is clear that when a high-ranking executive government official has the power to compel the actions of lower officials, that also creates the nexus. And I think when you look at all those factors taken together, the court can reach a conclusion, as the district court did, that Mr. Eaves has pled facts, which, as this court acknowledges, the court has to accept as true at this stage.
I mean, those are really high level functions that you're talking about that are possessed by virtually all state executives. I mean, the governor of virtually every state is, you know, the buck stops with them, for lack of a better term, with how the prison system runs in their state. What do you have that is more specific than those high-level functions? Those may be enough in Colorado State Court, but what do you have that would suggest, for purposes of the exception to Ex parte Young, that there's a connection between the governor and the decisions made in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. And I want to speak to the more specific allegations. I just want to make one point, which is states often do make determinations about how they want to structure the duties. So, for example, in Hendrickson, which is a case that this court decided, there the governor was sued but was found to not be a proper party under Ex parte Young because the Supreme Court of New Mexico has said that the governor was to be insulated from the union board. And so the state can decide a lot of influence over what are the specific duties of a governor. The state of Colorado here has done the opposite. In Raven v. Polis, the state said the governor is directly responsible for the CDOC. Now, to get to your question, Your Honor, about the specific allegations, there are several that Mr. Eaves makes. First, he alleges that he wrote to the governor to voice his concern over a policy that didn't allow him to possess sacred objects in his cell. He then alleges that he had a conversation with CDOC official Gypsy Kelso, who informed him that he had a conversation about that conversation with Mr. Polis. 6 months later, a new regulation was issued, which did not change any of the facts that Mr. Eaves alleged were burdening his rights, which, as the district court found, one could make the very plausible inference that that meant that Governor Polis was okay with the fact that this policy was the way that it was and that it was potentially violating someone's Mr. Eaves' rights. So that is one example, Your Honor. Another example is that when Mr. Eaves is denied his request to cleanse his cell, he has done so through a CDOC official who uses a memorandum issued by the governor. And there's another example where a different request that Mr. Eaves makes comes on the letterhead of the governor. And all of these examples show that the governor isn't simply so far removed from all of this. It's specific examples where we see CDOC officials invoking the power of the governor in denying his rights. And I think that's a very important aspect of the Ex parte Young analysis and shows that the government does have some, that the governor, excuse me, does have some connection here to the violations of Mr. Eaves' constitutional rights. And in that way, I think that this case is in some ways similar to Fowler, but I think that there are also allegations here that make this case stronger than Fowler in some ways. There isn't an executive order, but just like in Fowler, Governor Stitt was, the court pointed to the fact that Governor Stitt was directly responsible over the Oklahoma State Department of Health. Likewise, Governor Polis is directly responsible for the CDOC. The 10th Circuit instead in Fowler pointed to the fact that the Oklahoma State Department of Health invoked the executive order by the governor denying the amended birth certificates that were requested by the plaintiffs. Same here. You have CDOC officials that are invoking the power of the governor in denying Mr. Eves' rights. And in some ways, the allegations that Mr. Eves has made here are even more specific than those that in Fowler. So I think Fowler is very analogous to this case and is another reason why this court can feel comfortable affirming the district court's decision and finding that Governor Polis has some connection. And I just want to reiterate that the test is literally, does this person have some connection to the enforcement? This court has made clear that it doesn't require a special connection. It doesn't matter if there are other defendants involved. And in fact, I think the conversation we've had today about mootness and about transfer shows that, especially in the prison context where transfers happen so often, why you would want multiple defendants, or why you would want all the defendants who, as long as they have some connection, to be a part of the suit. And in this case, Mr. Eves has pled sufficient facts to show that that Governor Polis has some connection to the deprivation of his constitutional rights.
So I suggested to your opposing counsel that under Alden v. Maine, that the governor doesn't have more immunity rights in federal court than he would have in state court. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think in federal court, when it comes to the 11th Amendment immunity, any additional immunity they have is simply tied to this court's precedent of needing to find that the individual defendant at issue has some connection to the enforcement.
So you would disagree with that statement as a general matter. So if I said to you, if the governor is not immune in state court, he is also not immune in federal court, you would disagree with that?
I think there is a difference between the state and the federal court. Yes, yes. But and to be very clear with the court, I do think that in federal court, because of the 11th Amendment, this court's precedent does require a bit more. It does require showing that there is some connection between the individual and the acts here. And I believe that Mr. Eves' complaint sufficiently alleges that connection.
I have one more question. This, since we have this before us with a 12B6 and 12B1, where we consider the well-pled allegation as true, and all these facts now point to one prison, of which he now is stationed in another prison, even though the issue is the immunity issue, wouldn't we be giving an advisory opinion because he's no longer at the prison where he was? Wouldn't it be wholly an advisory opinion to say whether those facts under 12B6 are correct before the court?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
You think they may be facts that applied then, but do the facts apply now to where he's located?
I believe that they do. And for that reason, I don't think it would be an advisory opinion because, again, what Mr. Eves is complaining about, as the court in Jordan v. Sosa noted, are systemic, system-wide, uniformly applied policies that violated his rights while he was at Brent. But if he was at Sterling, it would be the same result.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Thank you.
I want to respond to counsel's representations about Mr. Eves' specific allegations in the amended complaint below. In particular, what we have characterized as vague and conclusory references to a memorandum issued from Governor Polis. No facts in the complaint about the date of that memorandum. No facts about its particular contents. No facts no attachment of the memorandum as an exhibit. That memorandum may be the COVID-19 executive order that is no longer in effect and therefore relates to mooted claims. There's no way for the trial court to know that. There's no way for this court to know on the record before it on this appeal because, again, Mr. Eaves did not provide some evidence of the governor's insertion of himself into the policies and procedures that were applied to Mr. Eaves at BCCF.
Do we liberally construe the amended complaint?
Yes, because he is pro se, but you do not have to accept implausible, non-well-pled allegations as true.
Does even a counsel litigant have to present evidence in support of allegations in a complaint?
Under Peterson v. Martinez, the holding from this court is that when state law imposes the specific duty complained of on one set of officials, the plaintiff can only overcome that with some evidence. That's the word used by this court, which suggests more than, again, implausible conclusory allegations.
Is there a statutory prohibition? And if so, can you cite it? That a governor cannot help his or her underling in crafting a policy?
Your Honor, what the state law that the governor relies on is CRS 17-1-103, subsections 1A, 8.5, and B, all of which start with the preface, the duties of the executive director of CDOC are, and then proceed to list, supervise the activities of private contract prisons, issue policies and procedures that govern CDOC, and then lastly, govern the personnel, supervise the personnel of CDOC. So that is the specific duty under Colorado law. It rests with prison officials, not with the governor.
Do we have to accept the Colorado Supreme Court's decisions about the level of control the governor has over CDOC and the state prisons?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. State law causes of action brought in state court forums to which 11th Amendment immunity does not apply.
That's a little, I'm not sure that's responsive. I guess what I'm asking you is the Colorado Supreme Court has decided that the governor has an intimate role, my words, not theirs, in the administration of CDOC and the prisons. And do we have to accept what they've found about that as far as our analysis in determining whether there's some connection?
No, Your Honor, and the reason for that is twofold. One, because the Colorado Supreme Court's decision did, in fact, rely on the governor's general executive authority over prisons. It did not rely on any specific provisions of state law that I just referenced and cited to the court. Second, Raven Court's statement that because the governor has, quote, final authority to order the executive directors of all state agencies to commence or cease any action on behalf of the state was a misquote of a federal trial court's decision in Sportsman's Wildlife Defense Fund versus U.S. Department of Interior, which in turn cited and misquoted the 11th Circuit's decision in Lucky v. Harris, which also said nothing about there was the Georgia governor's controller over executive directors. Lucky v. Harris contains no reference to the term executive directors. In fact, that case concerned whether the governor was an appropriate defendant to a challenge to indigent defendants' right to representation in state courts. So even the Colorado Supreme Court's decision in Raven is not grounded in state law, I would say, although I have acknowledged and do agree that the governor has the power to hire and fire. We ask the court to reverse this case or to determine that it's moot and, if needed, order supplemental briefing either before this court or to remand with limited instructions for the trial court, which this court has done recently in the Imposition v. Griswold case. Thank you.
No.
Thank you, counsel. Well done by both sides. This matter will be